This time in the Magic Kitchen, we are joined by author Christopher Hughes.
I'm Leander Witchwood.
And I'm Elise Wells.
And welcome to the Magic Kitchen podcast, where we talk about magic, kitchen witchcraft, herbs,
and everything in between.
Magic Kitchen Podcast is funded and supported by thewitchwoodteahouse.com, offering a variety of hand-blended loose leaf teas as well as loose herbs for all of your ritual, spell work, wellness, and everyday enjoyment needs. If you would like to support this podcast while sipping a great cup of tea, head over to thewitchwoodteahouse.com and find the magic that's in store for you.
Christopher Hughes is chief of the Anglesey Druid Order, a Mount Haemus scholar, and a member of the Order of Bards, Obeids, and Druids. He is a teacher, writer, workshop leader, and guest speaker at pagan events throughout the United Kingdom, Europe, and North America. He's the best-selling author of the Book of Celtic Magic, Ceridwen, and other titles, as well as the creator of the Celtic Tarot. He lives in Wales and can be found online at angleseydruidorder.co.uk. Welcome! It is so good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you. How lovely.
And we're super excited, too, because we've been reading the Book of Druidry, which is so far one of my favorite books this year. And we're going to be talking about your Yuletide Tarot, which is another exciting thing because I'm not a tarot person, but I enjoyed this deck. It's beautiful.
Oh, I absolutely love it. You know, when you've worked on a project for so long, right? Because it takes an awfully long time to bring a tarot to fruition. It took the best part of 3 years. And there was the search for the right artist at the beginning of that as well to somehow translate my matchstick men sketches into proper artwork.
I love that. You know?
And Erin did it so well so that she had to somehow delve into my head, you know, and peel all of these images out of this skull. And she did such a glorious job with it. And I just love them. And bizarrely, I've had mine, I think, since maybe July. It was frightfully early and we were in the middle of a heat wave here in the United Kingdom. And the Yuletide Tarot arrived and I'm like, drop all the tarot decks. I'm going for the Yule day in July. And I've been reading them ever since. So I just love it. I love it so much. They bring me so much joy and merriment. And yeah, totally in love with them.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say the art called to me. And I'm like probably like in the very minority of tarot readers where I literally have one deck. And I've had that one deck. It's the Wildwood Tarot by John Matthews.
Lovely.
I've never been called to read it with a different deck until this deck. Like truly, truly, this is the only one since that has called to me. And then I didn't, you know, even look. I saw the art and then I was like, wait, oh, it's also by a druid. So it's kind of funny to me because I think that's secretly the way I have to choose my tarot decks now.
I think the druid path is just calling you, so...
It always is.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because I have so many tarot decks in this house. It's absolutely ridiculous. I think we're nearing critical mass, you know, and every time the postman arrives, my husband is like, that felt like another tarot deck. What is wrong with you? You've got a problem.
That's good intuition.
But bizarrely, I'm the same as you, Elise. I tend to favor maybe three decks that I read from generally, but I love all my other decks as well. But because I give classes in tarot, I teach tarot, I need all those other decks for my classes, you see. And of course, exactly. They're tax deductible.
Necessary.
I was going to say it's a business write-off.
Exactly. I'm not sure if that really justifies my obsession, but I don't know.
It totally does.
Yeah, but sometimes I just get them for the appreciation of the artwork as well. And then there are others that I will dabble with and have a little fiddle with every now and again, you know, pull them out on special occasions, something like maybe the Halloween tarot or the trick or treat tarot. And now, of course, there's a Yule one. Who knew?
I know. It's kind of crazy. It took so long to have one. And I wanted to ask you, how did you choose the cards' themes when we're talking about Yuletide as a theme and the suits as well?
Do you know, it was quite a task, actually, and it was one that I didn't take too lightly. So some of the background to it was I came across the Christmas tarot in the Atlantis bookshop in London. And my friend Geraldine runs the Atlantis bookshop, and which has got all this fabulous history. And all the great and the goods have given talks at the Atlantis bookshop, from Aleister Crowley to Gerald Gardner, Doreen Malley. They've all been there. And I saw this deck, thought, right, I'm having this. So on the train on the way home, I opened it and I was really disappointed. It was only the major arcana, which is fine. But then, you know, don't sell me a tarot if there's only 22 cards in it, you know? And the pictures weren't the whimsy Victorian scene that was sold on the box. They were very dark and they were very artsy. They were very nice in a way, but I couldn't read with them very well. So I was having a little bit of a tantrum about it with my tarot editor at Llewellyn Worldwide when she asked me, oh, have you had any new decks lately? And so I had a bit of a tantrum about this deck, throwing shade at this deck. And then she said, well, do you think you can do better? And I said, of course I can do better. She said, well, go on then. I thought, oh, damn you, Barbara Moore. Nice. I walked right into that one. And so I decided that that the major arcana would be the archetypal forces and energies of the Yuletide season. But of course, when you start looking into archetypal forces of Yuletide and midwinter, there's significantly more than 22 of them. I was like, oh my word, you know, how do you whittle them down to something that not only touches me, but hopefully other people might find intriguing? So it was really difficult to whittle them down to only 22 cards. But the minor arcana was not so difficult, because I figured that because the minor arcana cards are the little minutiae, the details of human life, I thought, well, we all have connections, whether it's love or hate or indifference towards the Yuletide season. We all have a connection to it in the Western world. So I placed all of those connections, the stresses, the joys, the wonder and the magic into the minor arcana through the four elemental suits. And that was a joy, because I could not only pick elements of my own life and my family and my friends' lives to place in the cards. Yeah, it was the major arcana that was the trickier one, you know, the one that was like, oh, and sometimes it was really obvious what should be there. And you know, sometimes we try to be a little bit too clever about things. So initially my chariot was Freya, and she was being pulled by her cats, and it wasn't working for some reason. And then Erin, the artist, she said, shouldn't it be Santa Claus on his sleigh? And I'm like, of course it should. it was really obvious what really should have been as part of the chariot. And so I wanted that whimsical children's illustrated book kind of feel to it. The kind of images that were evocative of the special Christmases that I had as a child in the 70s. And I think she captured the essence of that whimsy. So I just love it. I absolutely love it.
Well, I'm actually visiting the US as we're recording this, but where I grew up here in Pennsylvania was Amish country. So we had Victorian Christmases in a sense, because all of the local community events were not electrified. They were gaslit lamp. You know, smell of like a gaslit lamp, like that smells like Christmas to me. Because when we go out to like the wider community stuff. And like, it's a misconception that the Amish are like, they call us the English, like the non-Amish or the English, they, you know, people say like, oh, they don't interact. You can't take pictures of them, all this stuff. Like, that's not really true. Like, if you're part of the community, you're still part of the community. So Actually, that's what a lot of the imagery struck me with, was like, it reminded me of my childhood, but I felt like a Victorian child sometimes as a kid. Minus the wasting diseases.
Yeah, but perhaps as well. What I hope is that the whimsy will evoke memories in people who look at the cats. You know, whether they're looking at them from a nostalgic point of view or from a romantic vision of midwinter, or from actual memories that they might have had. You know, and I think when you're, whichever decade you are a child between, like 8 and 12, I think that's the era that defines your sense of what is festive, Yule-ish, midwinterish. You know, and for me, it was the
it's true.
No, towards the end of the 80s and towards the end of the 70s into the early 80s, because I'm much older than I look. I know I don't have wrinkles, but I had access to embalming solutions for 32 years. Shh, don't tell anyone.
Well preserved.
Well preserved, soaked in gin. That's the secret.
You gotta start drinking that gin.
So I love that whimsy, you know, it was the whimsy that I wanted. And I don't know how, if you're familiar at all with the works of an English artist called Jill Barklem. She illustrated and wrote a series of books in the 90s called Brambley Hedge, if that rings a bell. And it's about a community of mice who live under Brambley Hedge in the English countryside. And Erin has kind of captured the essence of that feel as well. And she must have loved the Yuletide season, because so many of those books are focused around that particular period of the cycle of the seasons and the magic of that. And they're really, really pagan in their expression, you know, all the little chants and verses that the mice sing in relation to the season are extremely pagan adjacent.
Well, I haven't heard of Brambley Hedge, but now I'm definitely going to find it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it sounds like the wind in the willows.
Yes, doesn't it? So, and the one that's the most, the ones my favorite were the Winter Story and the Secret Staircase. So if you have a Google of those, you'll see these beautiful illustrations. And I wanted to capture something that ran along those lines, you know? So yeah, really pleased.
Oh yeah, I just pulled it up. Oh my gosh, I want to crawl in.
That's it. You want to crawl in, you know? And they make pies. They make pies, mice making pies. And whenever I read those books, I can kind of smell the pies. I love a pie.
Yeah.
Well, the art style in this reminded me something of my childhood too, but they were little, like quick little books. Like the one that I remember from a kid was like Misty Morgan and Morgan Morning. They were like just these quick little children's books that had this great illustration in them. And, you know, they were lessons of, you know, not being too proud, not being too greedy, that sort of thing. And so the art in this really kind of took me back to childhood and reading these books, because I usually would get one on Christmas.
And, right.
And I would sit there, I would just read them over and over again. I found one the other day in a box of, you know, knickknacks and stuff from my childhood. And it was so read so many times that the binding was just falling apart.
Well and truly loved. Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because even when I'm not one that's I'm not a particularly sickly individual, but if I do have a bout of cold or flu or something, I have the same. I have various books that are my comfort blankets, and one of those is The Secret Staircase. You know, even at 52 years old, it still brings me an immense amount of comfort and joy. You know, it appeals to the whimsical druid that lives in me.
Yeah.
I love that.
Real talk. Leandra and I could be trying to sell you socks or a VPN or that cereal everybody talks about, but we like to keep it witchy around here instead. And we can only do that because of the support of listeners like you. When you're joining my magical living community on Patreon, you're not only getting weekly shadow work journal prompts, new moon and full moon rituals, exclusive videos, exclusive meditations, plus bonus episodes of the Magic Kitchen podcast, but you're seriously keeping the lights on in the Magic Kitchen. Thank you for listening and reviewing the show. And if you're ready to meet me in the Magic Kitchen, pop over to patreon.com/EliseWells and start your free trial. Let's deepen your magical practice together.
Can we do the reading?
Yeah. Should we do a reading?
Yeah, I would love to like demonstrate to the audience.
Right, hold on. So I'm looking at Elise there. So right. Is it Elise? Is that how I pronounce your name?
Yep, perfect.
So I'm looking at you. So I'm thinking of you as I pull these cards, okay? So let's see what we pull. Okay, so I've pulled the Eight of Good Cheer, which is the Eight of Cups. I've pulled the Nine of Gifts, which would be traditionally the Nine of Pentacles. And I've pulled the Eight of Gifts, or what would be the Eight of Pentacles. So when I look at this, okay, there's seemingly a situation in your life where you're either emotionally exhausted by a particular situation in your life, or you've just got to the point where you think, do you know what? I've done what I can in this situation. So perhaps now it's time for me to kind of like walk away, but not necessarily in a way that is hostile or resentful or regretful, but in a way where you kind of feel like I've done what I can in this particular situation. It's now time for me to move on. So the mercurial components of your own personality are speaking to your emotional component. So all of the communicative aspects within you are now speaking to your emotional side, and they're trying to have a little conversation. And that conversation is trying to get you to a place of security and stability in which you can be the leader, the sovereign of your own being and your own existence, in a place that is content and a place that is fulfilled. And the Eight of Gifts, again, is a mercurial component. It's a communicative component, but this time it's speaking to the physical part of yourself rather than the emotional part of yourself. So if you're in a situation where you feel or you want to implement change, perhaps reel in a little heart, but also reel in a little head and have a little balance between the emotional and the logical or rational side of your persona. And the balance or the moderative point of those things is a place of contentment and a place of power that comes from the sovereignty of your ability to lead, not only in your own life, perhaps also in the lives of others.
Thank you. Oh, that's very interesting.
Those are your three cards.
Yeah, thank you. I think that fits. That fits what Leandra and I were talking about before.
Oh, lovely.
I was just going over that.
I could see you were like, oh, I know what that is.
So let's see what they'd say for Leandra. So I didn't pick one card for you. I picked three, you know, because I find that sometimes when people pick one card, you don't get enough on either side, right? You know, mm-hmm. to give it much of the way of context, you know. So Leandra, oh girl. So you have the Four of Gifts, or the Four of Pentacles in the, then you have the Queen of Gifts. All right. So far you've got two gifts, but then you have a major arcana card, which is the Magus, or the Magician. So the major arcana card is the card in here that sort of like kicks the asses of the other two cards. But within this situation, there's the Four of Gifts, particularly in the Yule deck, I particularly love because it has this quality of Ebenezer Scrooge. It has a quality of of keeping things close to your chest, but it's keeping the things close to your chest that refer to the things that are secure and stable in your life, okay? Because all of the fours, they represent the ability for us to literally be able to build four walls around something or to keep something in and keep something stable. But there is sometimes an issue that when we try and do that with a little bit too much gumption and gusto, that we might become possessive over those particular elements. And within this particular reading, there is a person who exudes the quality of the Queen of Gifts, or the Queen of Pentacles. So if you think of the Queen of Pentacles, she represents the earth of water, okay? So if you think, what on earth is the earth of water? Well, it's all of the molecules that go into the making of water. And the person who is expressive of the Queen of Gifts is somebody who is very maternal, somebody who is very motherly, not necessarily in a stifling kind of way. That would probably be more of the Queen of Swords. You know, you don't want to crush her, because Queen of Swords, she can be a shady bitch when she wants to. But the Queen of Gifts isn't a shady bitch. The Queen of Gifts can be very comforting and very giving. So the message in there is that if there's a situation around you that's being restricted by physicality, what it needs is compassion and empathy that comes from a maternalistic instinct in order to moderate it. But this is also a journey that involves you generally. And the major arcana card that's swinging into this particular reading is the Magus, or the Magician, which essentially is as above, so below. But of course, in my Yule Tarot, it's the Druid collecting mistletoe from the sacred oak in the heart of the forest. So this is a card that implies that whatever the situations physically in your life are, and however they're expressing themselves, you always have a hidden quality to inject into any of the issues, problems, or things that need resolving in your life. And that quality is magic. And this card is a reminder to you that you are a magical person. But even when we're magical people, we can feel somehow as if either the world around us is not necessarily understanding the quality of the magical aspect of our lives and living, but it doesn't necessarily want to know either. But sometimes it needs that quality in order for it to be transformed or transmuted. So this particular reading is a message to you that regardless of the things that are happening in your physical life, always remember that you are magic. You are magical. You have the ability to get to the very heart, the very distilled quality and components of a situation, and affect it on that level for it to bubble up into physicality in a way that isn't as restrictive as the four of gifts, but contains also that quality that comes from the maturity and the compassion and empathy of the Queen of Gifts. But ultimately, the message there to you is, girl, you is magic.
Oh, and that is interesting too, isn't it, Leo?
Doesn't that totally, like, we were
so literally 5 minutes before you joined the call.
And it was interesting how you said specifically, like, barriers and building those four walls around us. Like, that's literally what I was talking about, like feeling boxed in.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Yeah. Well, remember, you have magic. You've got magic at your disposal.
Okay. All right.
Don't forget.
This bitch is magic.
That's a slogan. That should be on a t-shirt or a mouse hat. Okay.
That's the next project, making t-shirts. This bitch is magic.
Yeah.
Excellent. Oh my God, this has been fun.
Okay, I love it.
We can get into the Book of Druidry now. I know you've been itching for it.
I'm itching.
I love this book. This is an amazing book.
Yes. And, you know, we're still keeping the Yule theme if you're listening to this on Christmas Day and hanging out with us. We're still, you know, we're talking about the changing of the seasons. We're living with the wheel of the year. So, you know, it's still,
and totally, still fits thank you for hanging out with us, because this is fun. This is a good podcast.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's really good fun.
So let's start with, I think, what feels like the heart of the Book of Druidry, the Mabinogi.
Mm-hmm.
Tell our listeners, if they've never heard of the Mabinogi, what it is, why it's so important to Druidry, and why did this have to be such an important facet for the Book of Druidry?
Do you know, it's so the Mabinogi, or the Mabinogion, so there's a collection of tales in Wales, and there's 11 in total, and the entire collection is referred to as the Mabinogion, or the Epic of Youth, or the Tales of Youth, or Tales of the God Maponos, the Mabon. And within that collection, there are four branches, and they're the four branches of the Mabinogi. And each of these branches, not only do they contain mythical elements, but they also contain echoes of something much, much more ancient than the time in which they were written. So our scholars and academics and Celtic experts, they're all of the opinion that when you read the Mabinogi, the four branches in particular, whilst you can see the syncretic layer of the medieval period within them, once you look underneath that layer ever so slightly, what you can deduce is that it's written about a time where the Romans were approaching Britain, but they weren't quite here yet. They weren't quite here. So yes, you have a syncretic overtone of medieval Christianity, because that's who those people were. That was their lives. And that's what they wrote about. So they gave that layer to these stories. But when you scratch at them, what you find, of course, is mythology. And the beauty of mythology and, you know, the Book of Druidry and the Anglesey Druid Order that I had, and the teachings within it and the philosophies within it, come from this mythocentric approach. And what I love about mythology is that it can be seen everywhere, in every spirituality, every world religion. At their heart, at their core, they contain these elements of myth. And what I love about mythology is that mythology is something that never happened. Never happened. Never happened anywhere to anyone. But the secret is, they happen all the time. Myth never happened, but it happens out all the time. And regardless of what century we live in, what our problems are, we can find ourselves within that mythical landscape. And the beauty of the Mabinogi is that within that mythical landscape, we also meet our gods and our goddesses, some of our ancestral spirits, the wisdoms pertaining to those, and all of the other bodies of literature within the Welsh Bardic tradition that refer to the Mabinogi. And some of them are centuries older than the written myths, you know, or the myths that were last written in the medieval period. So I love the fact that a myth is an untruth that reveals an emergent truth, and that the truth that it reveals is within you. And within the Anglesey Druid Order, and hopefully as well within my book, what I try and press, what we try and get over to people, is the fact that a mythology is only talking about one person, and the person it's talking about is you. The myth is your myth, whether they're Greek, whether they're Welsh, whether they're Norse, whether they're Indigenous American. They're speaking about the individual who is engaging with them at that point in time. And I love that timeless quality to a mythology, in that they never happened, but they're happening right now to the individual that's engaging with them. And as a consequence of that, they become cornerstones, I guess, of the practice of my Druidry, and, you know, of the Druidry of the Anglesey Druid Order. They're imbibed, they're imbued with a spirit that reveals something of our own wisdom that's inherently there, just waiting to be revealed. And I fell in love with them when I was a child, and I'm still in love with them to this day. And every time I engage with them, I learn something new and different, you know?
Yeah, I really loved the way, now I'm going to do my best. I really studied your Welsh pronunciation guide at the back of the book, which I love that you included, by the way, because sometimes you brush up against a Welsh word. You're like, man, I wish I knew more about how to say this. But the way we start off with analyzing in your book, the pwyll qualities that we have.
Yes.
I mean, I read that part months ago at this point, but it comes up in my everyday. I'm like, oh, that's okay. I can see that. You know, it's a framework for
yeah, exactly.
for work.
And I think sometimes language can be a little bit of a stumbling block, because when somebody reads the Mabinogi and they come across Pwyll, what they see is the syncretic Pwyll, which is a man living in medieval Wales, and he's got all these hoo-has happening to him. But once a person understands that the word Pwyll is never a noun, it was never a personal noun, it's a word that has a plethora of meanings, like consideration, deliberation, intelligence, wisdom, care, caution. All of these things are elements of the human condition. So whilst Pwyll, for storytelling purposes, for the narrative, is of course presented to us as a medieval Welsh male, but as soon as you scratch at the surface, what happens is the mythological component of Pwyll as an element of you starts to come out. And that's what I find really exciting about Welsh myth in particular, because none of the, what we assume is a personal noun, none of them are. They're other, sometimes they're not even nouns. Sometimes they're adjectives. Sometimes they're verbs. Sometimes they're all of the above. You know, it's a cauldron of complexity and really perplexity, you know, unless you have a key to unlock it. And the first key is realizing that Pwyll was never a bloke in mid Wales. He is an element of you.
That's great. And it brings me to my question, because in reading through this with my community in the book club, I know a lot of my members came to stumbling blocks. They're like, this is so intense. Like, I really have to think on this.
Oh, but, really?
Yeah. Specifically when we got to the constitutions and expressing them and answering, you know, how, you know, like my understanding of my psychic constitution is expressed. And they were like, wait, I'm stuck here. How would you guide someone through that? If they're reading this book and maybe they're thinking too much into it, or maybe they're just stuck. Like, how would you navigate them to
the three constitutions?
Yeah. Or any part of it. I mean, so you talked about some deep stuff, but yeah, the three constitutions, let's go there. how would you navigate that? Yeah.
So I think ultimately when a person sits down to write a book, you're taking concepts and principles that they're not original, you know, they're there within the Western mystery tradition and within a culture generally. It's giving them another flavor or another taste that comes from a particular cultural continuum, in this case, from the Celtic cultural continuum. So the things like the, you know, the psychic constitution, the bodily and the worldly constitution, they're essentially three elements of ourselves. They're the elements that would equate to mind, body, and spirit, essentially. So if we reach a stumbling block, the easiest thing to do is to break it down to its most simplistic form. So somebody's psychic constitution, which would literally just be referring to who they are on a very subtle level, who they are on a level that feels the world rather than logicalizes or rationalizes it, or rather, you know, or moves through it on a physical level, but how they feel their way through the world. I think sometimes words like psychic or psychicism, is that a word? Can be a stumbling block, because sometimes I don't think a lot of people who come to a culture, especially if they're new to it, don't necessarily understand what that means. But ultimately, the psychic constitution of an individual is simply how they feel themselves in the world and in the universe. So I think if there's ever a stumbling block, it's kind of like stop and look and think, okay, so what's the author trying to get me to reveal about myself, and break it down to its very simplistic component. Because, of course, verbosity is part of the job of an author. You know, to flower and flounce things up a bit. But sometimes the flouncing and flowering can cause people to like, oh, I'm not sure how I'm going to relate to that. Yeah. So I always think, make it simple, break it down to the simplistic component of that paragraph or technique or advice, and try and feel yourself within it, within that landscape, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's what happens sometimes. We just overthink things or to making it too complicated or trying to, you know, flower it too much or.
Yeah, exactly. And I think ultimately everything is quite simple. And I love how Dion Fortune, one of the greatest occultists of the early 20th century, she had a phrase that said, before the ascent into spirit can commence, the descent into matter must be complete. And I love that because it implies that the descent into matter is knowing who we actually are. Yeah. Sometimes we can overcomplicate that and go through various therapeutic devices or self-exploratory devices to try and discover that. Whereas sometimes what you actually need is just a list.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Lying down a paper.
Like complicated.
Yeah. We love to complicate things. I love complicating things as well. But I really like that advice from Dion Fortune, you know, before we ascend into spirit, descend into who you are and find a comfortability in your own skin as you're progressing, as you're developing, as you're discovering new journeys and new avenues of spiritual expression. You know, always find who you are within it and what it's doing to you and what you can give to it.
It's so simple, yet it's not easy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it takes deconstructing, because if you grew up in a Christian background or really any Abrahamic religious background, we're taught that the power is without. It's out. It's over there. If you need help, go to the priest. You can't do that yourself. But like, to even go back to the Mabinogi, we're looking at these myths as how do they pertain to our inner power, instead of read this Bible story about, you know, Peter and his fish, and he can do this, but you can't. You know, we're putting ourselves back in the mythos and reminding ourselves that we have this empowerment. So I think that actually even the structure of your book brings us into that, because you've got space in there to write responses to the questions you're posing, which I think is really important. So many people have said to me, oh, but I don't want to ruin the book and write in it. I'm like, no, that's like embracing the book. It's the opposite of ruining it. You're enhancing your experience.
Exactly. Exactly. And can you imagine, you know, in 100 years time when that book finds itself in a secondhand bookshop somewhere in deep as dark as Montana and it's got all of those thoughts in it, you know?
Yeah.
And like somebody is like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. No, so,
well,
so,
and I'm a secondhand booker on purpose because I love when I find someone else's, you know, writings. Like, it's just great to see someone else's marginal notes. So
see, I don't like to write in it. Like even my highlighters are little tabs.
Oh, are they? I am the butcherer of books.
Same. Yeah.
But I love them so much. You know, I break their spines. I write in them. Marginalia is all over the place. And but I love marginalia. I go to my university library to study Welsh mythology. And what I find that really excites me is marginalia. And I have no idea who that person was or what they did or what they were doing there. But it transports me somehow into their mind, you know, and I love that. So that was part of the reason I wanted to do that. But you're so right, Elise, as well, because if we grow up and if we develop within the conditioning or the programming of a revealed tradition, we're led to believe that whatever happens within that revelatory doctrine is allegorical. But within mythology, they're not allegorical per se. They are literally talking about the human condition, and we are the human condition. So the allegorical components, while some people might enjoy looking for allegories, I would say that a mythology is significantly more than an allegory, that it is something that it's a response between a people and its land, and that it's a fusion of that song, of that story, of a people in relationship, not only with each each other, but also with the soil beneath their feet, which is why we've got all of these beautiful colors and diversity and vibrancy to our mythologies, because they're singing of that profound connection to the land. And that's what I love. And I'm very lucky, and I never take for granted that I live in a mythical landscape. You know, I look out of my window here just to my right, and just down on the other side of the estuary is the fort of Arianrhod, of the goddess Arianrhod. You know, Branwen died on the river just a few miles to the north of my home, and her legendary, her ancestral home is only 2 miles from my home. So these mythological landscapes are also very inspirational, and they still sing those stories to us today, causing us to fall ever deeper, not only in love with them, but also to discover who we are within that landscape. You know, love it. Love it.
That, well, the foundation of my practice is spirits of place. Actually, my business is Seeking Numina, which means sacred places.
Fabulous. I love that title.
Thank you. Yeah, people are like, what? I'm like, trust me, it fits.
I love it. I need that on a mouse mat.
Oh, I'll let you know if I get into the merch world. But actually, I did want to ask you about spirits of place and sacred places, because they sometimes, quite often, really get overlooked in wider pagan writings. And, you know, Druidry is unique, I think, in calling people back to that conversation of right relationship with the land and with animism, like capital A. How, I don't know how, where the question is in there, but I guess, well, on one hand, what is your favorite sacred place you've been to? Like, have you had any particular, I know that's like impossible. I also, living in Greece, it's the same. There's like all these mythical landscapes around me, but is there a place you've been where you had a particularly moving experience with the spirits of place that you could share with us?
Yes, very much so. I can pinpoint the exact time and date, and it's at a local site called Bryn Celli Ddu. And consequently, Bryn Celli Ddu has become the spiritual home of the Anglesey Druid Order. It's where we perform our civic rituals, our public rituals, all of our open rituals are performed there. And it's a beautiful site. It has a pudding-shaped mound, which is fairly large, that has a cruciform chamber inside of it with an aperture on the western side that allows the light of the midwinter sunset to infiltrate the center of the chamber. And the opposite side, the sun of the summer solstice, shines directly into the chamber and lights it up as if it's liquid gold. It's quite something to see. But above and beyond the physicality of that place is the spirit of that location and of that place. And years and years ago now, they discovered around that location a bunch of quartz pebbles. And the quartz are natural river polished quartz and or beach quartz. The island is full of quartz pebbles. But when they examined them, they found that they had microfractures. So these stones had been bashed together. Well, of course, it's like the part of me thought, hold on a minute. If you bash quartzite together, you release triboluminescence, which is the potential energy within quartz. And of course, that isn't something that came to me from an occult realm. It just comes from the fact that my watch had a silicon chip in it, which is made of quartz. So I understood that these had an inherent energy. So I took the stones and I went into Bryn Celli Ddu, into the chamber, 2 o'clock in the morning, and started bashing these stones together. And it releases triboluminescence, which is a dull orange light. But it's a striking light, and it's accompanied by a very powerful smell that is similar to a just used firework. So not quite gunpowder, but similar, like a gunpowder smell mixed with saltpeter that would be in a charcoal briquette, you know? So you get this olfactory sensation, you get the aural sensation, and also I'm singing my head off like a crazy druid at 2 o'clock in the morning. bashing these stones together. And then all of a sudden, I was very aware that Bryn Celli knew what I was doing and that she was remembering it. It was this sense of, I know what he's doing. I've seen that before. I know what that is. And suddenly I felt that I was in communication with her, and the communicative tool, or the tool for communication, was these quartz crystals, stones that I was bashing together. So the sound, the smell, I was altering my consciousness. And in that alteration, she was present. She was very, very present. And the hierophany, I love that word, hierophany, you know, when the sacred reaches out through the ordinary and touches you. And in that moment, she touched me, and I knew that I would never be the same again. And since then, which was, you know, many decades ago, we've moved to it being our sacred home. But what is beautiful is that all of the people who come there fall in relationship with Bryn Celli. Not only is she beautiful and mysterious and full of intrigue, but she tells us that we are in relationship with her, that we are a part of her community. Ironically, we're the least permanent part of her community. She will still exist in 10,000 years, and when we will just be blips on the universal conscious memory. But we have this tangible relationship with her, and it excites me, and it moves me, and it causes me to feel something that I can't feel with another human being. So I spend a lot of time there, not only with my community, but selfishly, I spend a lot of time there alone in the dead of night with my stones, you know, bashing the shit out of them. You know, because they cause me to see her, feel her, sense her, and be in continuous relationship with her, you know? And whilst, oh my gosh, there's so many other sacred sites that I could go on about. We'd be here till Tuesday.
I totally want to visit. And
Yeah. Just come and bring me. I've got a bunch of stones upstairs. I've got a shoebox full of stones.
Well, you mentioned Arianrhod, and she's actually right here. You probably can't see the picture, but she's behind me.
Oh, lovely. That's
one of my patronesses. And
fabulous.
So, yeah, that feeling of like they are present when you.
Very. There's mine. Can you see her?
Yes.
She's there.
Beautiful. Oh, see, I love it. I love it. I want to visit Wales for that purpose, and selfish purposes too, because I actually have ancestry in Wales. I cannot say the name of the estate that my ancestors built. I'm going to put it in chat for you so you can pronounce it because.
Oh, okay.
Because okay. I'm just that lame. Hang on. You can tell me what it says first, the chat. There we are. All right. It is that house.
That doesn't look like Welsh.
It's not? Okay.
That looks Scottish.
Is it Scottish? Okay. Because the listing that they gave me was in Wales. I'm like, well, I want to go visit this.
Oh. So
it's Scottish. Well, that I'm would visit be, Wales anyway.
That would be Auchinleck. That sounds very Scottish.
I love that. Okay.
But it might be a Scottish family that lived here. Yeah. Auchinleck. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that looks very, very much more, I would say, more Gaelic than it looks Brythonic.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you for clearing that up, because we were having a big discussion in my family about this. And I'm like, well, somebody says it's Wales and somebody says it's Scottish. Okay. Well, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I would say that it's not Brythonic, because one of it is because of the letter K.
K. Oh, interesting. See, the language is so curious. I love it.
Yeah. The letter K was utilized in the medieval period, but it hasn't been used for centuries. And now we don't have the letter K in our alphabet.
Interesting. We'll just get rid of it. It's done.
No, it's just Scottish. They're still cousins.
Excellent. Well, awesome.
Actually, that was another point I wanted us to hit on in this interview for our listeners, because you start the book in the intro, empowering people who aren't Welsh to connect with Druidry through the Mabinogi. So yeah, share with our listeners a bit about Celtic cultures and how important or not important having that blood connection necessarily is.
But see, the wonderful and magical thing about any of the Celtic cultures, of course, that there are six of them, the P Celts and the Q Celts, and the P's are Cornish, Breton and Welsh, and the Q are Manx, Irish and Scottish. But the wondrous thing about them is that it's not a bloodline. Nobody has a Celtic blood, you know? So my genetics, they're 100% British Isles, but my genes are connected to the bones of an ancestor that was found on the Gower Peninsula in South Wales, whose bones are 10,000 years old. So I have a genetic connection to that particular skeleton. But of course, the Celts were only here from 800 BC. 1000 BC maybe, before the Common Era to now. But my genes are much older than that. My genes are very much British, of the British Isles. So what does that mean, you know? But what it means is that the Celtic cultural continuum is exactly that. It's a continuum that is a cultural spread. It's the spread of ideas, of art, of philosophy. And when we trace that, the origins of the Celtic culture is mind-blowing. There's some evidence to suggest that Celtic culture started in the Xinjiang provinces of northern China, crossed across crossed Siberia, across the Russian steppe, fell into what is now Austria. People settled around Hallstatt, around the salt mines in Hallstatt, and then suddenly they invent iron. Or they discover iron and the manipulation of iron, and Celtic culture suddenly erupts in the guise that we know today. And all of those ideas carried by trade of iron spread throughout continental Europe and also into the British Isles. But when it came up into the British Isles and towards Ireland, the remarkable thing was that we already had a culture of the people of the stones, the people who built Avebury, the Ring of Brodgar, Stonehenge, Bryn Celli Ddu. All of these things are 7,000 years old. And a lot of writers have referred to those people almost as proto-Druids, because when the Romans encountered the Druids of Gaul, they themselves said, well, our teachings come from Britain. It's like, oh, hold on. So these are Celts. They've got this spirituality and this philosophy, but that seems to come from Britain. What's going on there? Well, it seems as if the culture was moving, but the culture is meeting pockets of indigenous ideas, indigenous languages, indigenous spiritualities, and fusing with those. So who knows the actual origin of Druidry? It might be that it was a fusion of Celtic ideas meeting Bronze Age and earlier Stone Age ideas. We can never prove that fully, but it seems as if something of that nature happened to what we understand today to be Celtic spirituality and Druidry. But of course, one of the keys to understanding Druidry is the name itself. The Druid re, the re at the end, makes it a verb. Druidism is something that you might study. That sounds really dull to me, you know? But Druidry is something that you do. It's something that you are actively participating in. So when Celtic cultures spread, the implication is that they're still spreading. They're still moving throughout the world. And of course, we can see that so much in our culture. Over the last 300 years, the influence of Celtica, the ideas within Celtic culture, has spread to all four parts of the globe. And the reason it spread is because it's not a bloodline. It spreads because it's a cultural cauldron of ideas and principles and philosophies. So that anyone can participate in. And there are some naysayers, you know, that I know myself of, you know, Celts will go, you can't have what we have, you know. But they point a finger without realizing they're pointing three fingers straight back at themselves. You know,
it's the same. No. Yeah. Well, and people ask me that about Greek mythology. They're like, can I work with this pantheon? I'm like, of course you can. The Greeks were you know, colonizers. They were out there spreading as far and as wide as they could. And exactly. Unfortunately, there is still movements. They're small and not getting traction, but there's some movements in Greece to like keep it pure. Like, and because my mother's American, even though my dad's, you know, born and raised Greek, I'm a Greek citizen. People will come for me all the time. Like, stop calling yourself Greek. I'm like, I don't know how to be more Greek. I don't know what to tell you.
Oh, I love it. That's so true. You know, but people will always come for people. That's one thing we can be assured of. Taxes, death, and people will come for people.
Definitely.
Yeah. Haters going to hate.
Haters are always going to hate, you know. But I love sharing my culture. And I know there are questions of cultural appropriation, but essentially, I think even that can be broken down to a very simplistic thing. Cultural appropriation is when you take the piss out of a culture by either monetizing it or profiting from it, or literally just ignoring it and only focusing on what you want to get out of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I mean, no, do a bit of Duolingo, you know, learn something about the political situations in those countries and a bit about the people and what struggles they might have, you know, and try and help them or maybe support a charity in those particular places that you're drawn to. There's so much that we can do to offset cultural appropriation. And the key to that, the key between cultural appropriation and appreciation is education, you know, and just understanding something about said culture and investing in it, you know, because if you're drawn to it, you obviously love it. So invest a little bit more, you know. And so here in Europe, of course, we're a cultural melting pot. I mean, look what the Romans did, you know. They say, oh, the Romans were the greatest polytheists ever. Honey, the Romans were polythievists. They stole all the gods. They're like, oh, we'll have that one. Have you seen her over there? Oh, I've just found one in Germany. She's fabulous. We'll have her. You know?
Yeah. And then in Bath, they're like, we'll keep Minerva, but we like your Soulis. Yeah. Let's do both.
Yeah. Let's have a fusion.
Yeah. Know? Why not both?
And it's the same with, you know, the horse goddess. You know, you've got Rhiannon, which was evolved from an earlier figure, Rigatona. The Romans were like, oh, we'll have a bit of her. We'll call her Epona, you know? Yeah. So, and we've been doing it forever. And I think ultimately is, don't take the piss, you know? Be humble in the exploration and enjoy it. And if you can do anything to help that expression, you know, do it, you know?
Yeah. You heard it here first, folks.
Do it.
Just do get it out there.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Have good intentions, isn't it?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I think ultimately, if you boil down all of the wisdoms, philosophies, teachings from every single spirituality and world tradition all over the world, you could fit it on the back of a tarot card, you know? And if you were to find that tarot card would say, try not to be an asshole.
Yeah, that's that.
And then we'll flower that then into the various traditions that we all love and follow. And but I think it's like, you know, when you break it down, it's very simple. So it's like I love sharing of my culture because I love it so much. So, and I'm very lucky I get to travel the world, you know, to share the wisdoms within them, because whilst the wisdoms may have a particular locality specific aspect to them, so much of the wisdom and philosophy is not locality specific. It's human specific. It's specific to who we are. And I think when we take those stories and we apply them to our own living, we can evolve and develop those stories to be appropriate for the 21st century. Because I think sometimes what we forget about mythology is that we need to still be telling them, but telling them through the lens of the 21st century, you know? So it's like, so people are always surprised when I talk about the relationships I have with my gods and goddesses. So like Arianrhod or Ceridwen, Whenever Arianrod to me, she's always in skinny jeans. She's got beautiful, stylish, but affordable boots and a really nice little cropped jacket, you know, in some kind of like, I don't want to say polyester because she's not that cheap, but
no,
in a man-made fabric. And this is how I see them. I see them as I would see my friends and family. I see them within the construct of the modern world. Even though their stories are old, they're also timeless and they belong to every time and no time at all. So, yeah, I could go on. As you can tell, I quite like all this stuff.
Oh, I know. Me too. Me too. I know. I also, Wales has been on my list for a very long time to visit.
Oh, do come. Oh, and when you do come and participate in the ancient Druid ritual of afternoon tea.
Oh, please. Yes.
Ooh, I shall. Well,
That's what I do is tea. I blend tea for a living. That's my main
Oh, you
job.
Do?
Yes. Yeah, so I will bring you tons of tea that I.
Oh, lovely. Oh, what a lovely thing to do. That's and totally enchanted me. What a lovely, lovely thing to do.
Yeah, and there are good teas, like Witchwood Tea House teas. They're unlike any other.
Mm. How fabulous. She's got one there, look.
Yeah. Shameless plug.
I love it.
How can listeners follow you and learn more about the Anglesey Druid Order or buy your books?
So the Anglesey Druid Order can be found just by Googling Anglesey Druid Order. Our web address, I think, is angleseydruidorder.co.uk. We also have a public presence on Facebook, and I'm on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook under my name, which is spelt peculiarly, KRISTOFFER, and then Hughes. So I'm quite easy to find. I think I could be better at the whole social media thing, but, you know, I'm 52. People need to give me a break, you know. And I look at sometimes at the younger members of the order, you know, and they're there. They've got 400,000 followers. They're posting every day. I have no idea where they get that imagination from. I'm not that imaginative. So I'm there on the usual suspects. The only thing I could never get my head around was, I don't think it's even called Twitter anymore. Is it called X or something?
I don't know. I'm not on it either. Yeah. I never was. So
I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. But I do rather like TikTok and Instagram and Facebook. So yeah, so I'm pretty easy to find. And then if people went to Llewellyn.com and to search for my name, they'll see all of my books and some blog posts and stuff that occasionally go up on Llewellyn as well. So they're always very kind to me, you know, and I love working for Llewellyn. They're just lovely. They're such a lovely bunch of people and they look after me very well.
Excellent.
Oh, great. Well, thanks again for being here. And I hope everybody listening has a wonderful Yuletide season.
Absolutely.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Merry midwinter. Merry mistletide. Nadolig Llawen. Bon Noel. All of the above.
All of it.
Isn't it? Feliz you. Navidad. What else do I know?
Kala Kristugina in Greek.
Oh. Ooh, say that again.
Kala, good. Kristugina. Kristugina
is
Christmas. Oh. Yeah.
And I could say Huva Yuleva, which is Finnish for Merry Christmas.
Nice.
So I speak just a little bit of Finnish.
Merry meet.
Merry part.
And merry meet again. Thank you for joining us on the Magic Kitchen podcast. Please visit my website, leandrawitchwood.com, for news, information, and more episodes.
I'm Elise Wells, and I can be found at Seeking Numina on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and seekingnumina.com. That's seeking, NUMINA.